Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Brown v. Bank of Galveston.
May I please report, Mr. Kenneth K. will present for the next petition.
May I please report. In this case, after a jury trial in which all issues were answered favorably to the plaintiff, Vincent Brown, the trial court, after taking motions for entry of judgment and motions for judgment NOV filed by the parties under consideration for over 3 years, decided that there was no evidence whatsoever to support any of the jury's answers and granted a judgment against the plaintiff. The facts in this case, the judgment of the trial court was affirmed by the Court of Appeals based on the argument that Vincent Brown was not a consumer as to the bank and thus was not entitled to recover under the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Vincent Brown, a married man, bought a vacant lot and thereafter hired a contractor, Marcelino Campion, to build a house on that lot for Vincent and his wife and his family. Vincent and the contractor agreed to certain plans and specifications and signed the papers required and prepared by the contractor's bank's attorney, Bill Ryder, who also represented in the trial court below the Bank of Galveston in this case. It was admitted that Mrs. Brown did not sign any of those papers, and it was also admitted by all the parties that before the papers were signed, Campion began work on the property.
Why didn't Mr. Brown say something about his wife before all that?
He was never asked about his wife.
So
he told Mr. Campion about his wife, but he never met with Mr. Ryder, he never met with the bank, he never said anything because he wasn't asked, are you married, by the bank or the bank's lawyer.
He was asked to make an affidavit if anybody else had an interest in the property. He said no.
I do not recall that from the trial testimony. I recall in the trial testimony, Campion admitted that he knew about Mrs. Brown. I remember that Vincent was asked, he had signed some papers with regard to permanent financing for Fort Worth Mortgage Company, and he indicated in that document that he was a single man. And it was true. It was less than a month later under the testimony, including the marriage certificate, that Vincent got married. So at the time that he signed that application for Fort Worth Mortgage Company, he was telling the truth, and thereafter he got married. Mr. Campion knew all along that at the time that Vincent and Campion were dealing, Vincent was a married man.
Mr. Cady, the bank also succeeded to the $15,000 purchase money lien in the underlying real estate, didn't it?
The bank took an assignment from Amico Credit Union with regard to the vendor's lien. That is correct.
Is there any question about it being a holder in due course of that lien?
No, there is no question about it being a holder in due course of that lien.
And in this case, the real issue here is whether or not the bank was a holder in due course of the material and mechanic lien such that they should be subject to the set-off for the cost of completion based on their lien. Is that really what the argument is here, that they were, because it cost some additional money to complete it, the lien was not for the full amount of the loan, but for something less, and therefore they could not have used their self-help foreclosure. They had to use the judicial foreclosure.
I don't think that holder in due course comes into play at all with regard to the M&M lien. There's no question about that. The bank foreclosed on Campion and therefore succeeded to not only his rights, but also his obligations under the various agreements between Campion and Brown. And therefore, it's our argument that the bank became the contractor. The bank had a duty to complete the house in accordance with the plans and specifications that Brown and Campion had agreed upon, and that until it did, under the terms of the documents which the bank's lawyer prepared, it could not demand the full amount, and it could not foreclose.
It couldn't foreclose on the lesser amount?
It couldn't foreclose on any. There are cases which we have cited to the court in the brief which have a similar, very similar fact situation where there's a vendor's lien and a mechanic's lien that are signed only by the husband and not by the husband and the wife. And the bank attempts to foreclose. In one of them, and I'm sorry, I'm not good with case names, but cited in the brief. One of them, the husband and wife attempted to enjoin the foreclosure. The trial court denied it and allowed the foreclosure to go forward. The Court of Appeals reversed that and said that, no, if we allow this, the wife had not signed all the necessary documents. The Villarreal case comes to mind where both the husband and wife had signed the initial papers. The husband renewed and extended, which is what the bank got Mr. Brown to do with regard to the vendor's lien all by himself. There was already a divorce, but the wife had the right to live on the property. In the Villarreal case, cited to the court in our brief, foreclosure was not allowed because the wife had not signed the renewal papers.
Why can't the lien holder foreclose on the interest it does have, which is his?
It's
at least got his.
There are two reasons for that. In one of the cases that we cited to the court, that argument was made, and the court said, no, if we allow that, it emasculates, that's the word that the court used, the homestead rights of the parties. I'm certainly aware that this court has recently held in a tax case that you can foreclose on the rights of the husband, but that the succeeding bank has to purchase the rights, the vested homestead rights of the wife. But that's not what we've got here. And the bank certainly made no claim in attempting to foreclose on the liens that it had, that it was only foreclosing on the vendor's lien. It contended that it was foreclosing on everything and bid the property in for some $65,000. Under this court, under your questions, implied there, I believe, that what you've got is the bank now has to remit some approximately $50,000 because it only has a $14,000 or $15,000 lien. It bid the property in for more. Therefore, it owes some $50,000 and can only buy Vincent's rights, which is a half interest, and not the vested homestead rights of the wife.
But whatever the truth of that is, this is a DTPA case.
It is a DTPA.
And the question is, if the bank has some right to foreclose on something, even if it did more, it thought it had more than it did, or thought it had more than it turns out to have had, how is that a DTPA violation?
Because the bank was contending that it had the right to do more than it did.
Well, surely it's not a DTPA violation to make a legal claim once a dispute has arisen that these are my rights. I have these rights. You have these rights.
The bank's claim was not under the vendor's lien. The bank's claim, all the letters to the bank, from the bank to Vincent, talk about our rights under the M&M lien contract, under the builders and mechanics lien contract. We get to foreclose under that. The notices of foreclosure said we're foreclosing under our M&M lien contract. One of the letters, I believe it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 21, that you have before you, tells Vincent, you've got to finish the house. We acknowledge that the house is not finished. You've got to finish the house under your own cost and expense. Alternatively, we'll finish it if we foreclose and get possession. The bank acknowledged all along and had acknowledged long before it took over the contract rights of Compion that the house was not being built in accordance with the plans and specifications.
Although the house was not finished, I guess the dispute is over how close to being finished it was, because the Browns were living in the house and have been for some time. Still are.
Compion contended in his testimony at times that the house was completed in accordance with the plans and specifications, and contended at other times that all he had done was make it livable. What he had done after he walked off the job and the bank assumed his contractor role and persuaded him to go back out was to do things like stretch the carpet and hook up the air conditioner. But the bank acknowledged that the house was not complete, and the jury found that the total damages, actual damages to Vincent for not following the plans and specifications, for using inferior quality merchandise, for doing a bad job, for the work that Vincent did himself just to assist in making the house look warm, were some $53,000. This is on a house that the total purchase price, including both the lot and the house, are supposed to be in the neighborhood of $75,000.
Now, all the time that this is taken, have the Browns paid out money?
They have paid a little bit to bring the house up to where it was livable. They have not paid any rent to the bank, if that's what you're asking. They've not paid the taxes. They've not been asked to. They have paid insurance on the house so that their interest is insured.
But payments on either of these notes, there have been no payments?
There have been no payments. And the bank does not contend you owe us $500 a month. The bank contends you owe us the deficiency. You don't owe us for the $75,000 anymore, Mr. and Ms. Brown. You owe us for a deficiency.
And after the foreclosure.
After the foreclosure. And the bank never contended, was not going to make the permanent financing. The permanent financing was going to come from Fort Worth Mortgage. The bank never contended we'd want $500 or $600 or $700 a month. The bank just said, pay us the entire $75,000. And if you don't do that, no, we will not make a subtraction for the incompleteness. No, we will not complete the house. And when on the witness stand, I asked the banker, Mr. Byron, why didn't you do that? And he said, we're not in the business of completing houses. I'm not in the business of building either. When I have a construction project to do, and it's something beyond my very limited capabilities of hammering a nail or two, I call a contractor or a painter or a plumber. And the bank certainly could have done that, but that the bank didn't want to do unless, as they said in their letter, not from the witness stand, we take over the house. If we get the house, said the bank, we're going to finish it before we try to sell it.
Well, following up on Justice Heck's question, what DTPA violations specifically are you contending the bank made?
I think the bank committed many DTPA violations. We need to remember that they became the contractor. First, they insisted that Vincent pay the full amount of the note with interest when the house the bank knew was not completed in accordance with the plans and specifications. The bank, the contractor, knew that there was no breezeway between the house and the garage as required by the plans and specifications, and yet did that they received the full amount of the note. There's a recent case, not in the brief, simply because it was not at that time in existence, called KC Roofing versus Abudis, I believe. I think out of the title court of appeals, which said that when you acknowledge that the work is not completed, but you insist nonetheless that you receive the full payment, that is a DTPA violation. The bank, as the contractor, knew that the garage was put in the wrong place. Nonetheless, did nothing about it, made no subtraction. The bank knew as the contractor from the plans and specifications that there was to be a covered patio when there was none. Knew that there was to be a fireplace, but there was none put in by the contractor, Compion, or by the bank. Knew there was, and did what? There was one put in after the fact, not the same kind as desired initially by Mr. Brown, after he took possession of the house with Compion's approval. But no subtraction was to be made for that. The same can be said about the raised brick hearth, which is called for in the plans and specifications. Again, that was done by Mr. Brown with no subtraction. The bank, as the contractor, knew that there was supposed to be indirect lighting in accordance with the plans and specifications, but there was none. There was supposed to be a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf, but the bank, as contractor, did not put one in and insisted that the house was completed anyway.
Is there any way for an interim lender not to be a contractor?
Oh, certainly.
How would that be?
First, they don't have to foreclose.
Well, assuming they want to get paid, is there any way for an interim lender not to be a contractor?
Yes. They can say, Mr. Brown, you go fix the house. Submit, obviously, reasonable bills for what it takes to fix the house in accordance with the plans and specifications. In other words, if you were going to have a wooden deck, we're not going to let you have one made out of some kind of fancy gold-plated material, but you get a wooden deck. And we're going to make that subtraction. The bank, in the documents which it drew, allows it to do that. That is to say, make the subtraction. You finish it at your cost, and then we'll make that subtraction. The bank has another opportunity also. The bank, for its own protection, it will be happy to tell you, makes periodic inspections of the house and did so in this case. During those periodic inspections, noted that there were deficiencies, wrote to Compion about it, talked to Compion about it, but continued to allow him to draw funds. There's a recent case out of the Tyler Court of Appeals, which held that a bank, a finance company, can stop the wrongful action simply by refusing to allow the continued draws, and that the making of the continued draws is a DTPA violation.
One question. If Plinacan is distinguishable, what is your argument for why your clients are consumers as to the bank?
Let me begin by saying I do not think Plinacan is distinguishable. But assuming that it is, because that is your question, I think that it is distinguishable because in Plinacan, both Mr. and Mrs. Plinacan signed the appropriate documents at the bank's request, and here that did not happen. Only Mr. Brown did. And therefore, when they foreclosed upon Mrs. Brown, I think that the bank, that the Browns are consumers, and therefore can go after the bank for the bank's wrongful actions, not for Compion's wrongful actions. The bank was with Easterling, the contractor, but not with Plinacan, the purchaser. Not with Plinacan, the purchaser. There is nothing in any of the court's opinions, either this court or the Court of Appeals, that indicated that the bank and Plinacan had any contact with each other until after Easterling started messing up and the bank foreclosed on Easterling and took over, then foreclosed on its own.
So is your position that regardless of what stage a bank or lender comes into play in a transaction like this, that the homeowner or the home purchaser or home builder would be a consumer as to that lender?
That's correct, because the consumer, from whose viewpoint we must look at this, has got only one purpose in mind. He's got a very narrow view. I'm trying to buy a house. I don't care whether Compion has the money in his own pocket or whether Compion has to get interim financing. That's none of my... I don't care. All I care about is that at the end of this deal, I'm going to get a house. Clearly a consumer product.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from responsor.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig Stahl will present arguments to the respondent.
May it please the court, Craig Stahl on behalf of Bank Galveston. There are quite a few factual inconsistencies that I would point out from the record in response to some of Mr. Kay's arguments. I will come back to those in a moment. Mr. Kay wants to characterize this case and reasons why the courts below ruled in favor of the Bank of Galveston as something different than what they really were. The underlying facts, he mentioned them. His client signed a note back in 1985. He's never paid one cent on that note. His client has been living in that house that was completed in April of 1987. It was completed prior to the bank's foreclosure in December of 1987. That house was complete and his client has paid and lived there without paying one cent.
Mr. Stahl, is Mr. Kidd correct that the bank has made no request for any payment of any kind?
There have been numerous settlement offers and discussions, Your Honor. I'm actually not privy to them. I didn't do the trial below. I came involved at the appellate level. It's my understanding during those settlement discussions, yes, the bank was trying to get some kind of an accommodation worked out, but I don't know and I can't speak actually in response to Mr. Kidd's comment there. The contractor received the bank's money. Just a text question, yes, the Amico lien, the vendor's lien, was paid off with the bank's money, and the bank took that. Mr. K acknowledges that the bank holds that lien and held that lien. And contrary to what Mr. K said, when the bank foreclosed, it foreclosed on both of those liens. The M&M lien that it obtained through foreclosure on Mr. Compion, the contractor, as well as the vendor's lien that it had paid for from buying the land, for paying for the initial land purchase for.
Right. Question.
Yes, sir.
You said the bank bought the credit company union's lien.
They provided the funding, the interfunding to Mr. Compion.
They paid it off.
Had paid it off.
So the mechanics and material was lien, was first lien.
No, was that, well, it's in second at the time, Your Honor.
No, I understand, but if you paid it off, don't they get a release, and then the mechanics lien becomes the first lien, which is the whole purpose for the banks buying it off in the first place, isn't it?
It was renewed and extended in.
So it was wrapped up in the money they were going to advance to build the house?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is it correct that they got an assignment of the contractor's M&M lien when the thing went into a problem?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that they foreclosed on that?
They foreclosed on that as well as the other vendor's lien, which I believe was specifically in the notice of foreclosure and the foreclosure document.
Was there ever a release given to...
of the vendor's lien, the M&M
yeah.
vendor's lien? No, I don't believe there was.
So there were, as far as the record is concerned, there's still
two
there. But they owned them both.
Yes.
Did they merge then because of the renewal and extension?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Mr. K wants to argue that we should just ignore the underlying vendor's lien. Both liens still existed. Both liens could be foreclosed upon, I believe.
Well, but they both foreclosed under the mechanics lien. What about the argument that because they took over that position, they were obligated to whatever the contractor was obligated to do, and that was allow a completion and to give credit for the amounts paid to complete the house?
2 points of response to that, Your Honor. First, Mr. Kidd, without any authority, asserts that the bank somehow had all the obligations of the contractor to complete
well,
the house.
Well, where did their rights come from?
Well, the rights to the finance, their rights to enforce the note, their rights to enforce the underlying security that underlies that note came from their foreclosure of Mr. Compion. But there's no contractual obligation whatsoever for them to undertake Mr. Compion's job. They're an interim construction company. They were not supposed to be the permanent financier here.
I understand that.
Mr. Brown already had that lined up with someone else. Mr. K wants to say that we have all these things that we didn't do that were Mr. Compion's obligations. This court, in the Ogden case, which interestingly came down a few months after Flanagan, said that foreclosure on a in a context where there's a provision in the mortgage document that says that you may foreclose on a partially completed home. And that's what happened here. We have the exact same language, because it was a state bar form. Mr. K wants to say that the bank's lawyers drafted it. The bank's lawyer provided the state bar form. This court, Home Savings v. Guerra, said that provision of a standardized form does not constitute involvement in the sale transaction. They provided a bar form. That bar form, and it's the exact same language as this court saw in Ogden, allow the bank to make a demand for foreclosure and go forward on foreclosure on a partial completion.
Well, if that's the case, how much money is the bank entitled to say that they are owed if it's a partially completed house?
Well, Your Honor, the facts in this case were that the house was actually completely completed
by the time they foreclosed.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, let me back up. Under the transaction that you say was purely financing, how much money did the bank advance to the contractor before the bank got involved? Did they advance the total $65,000 or less?
$64,500 something, Your Honor, yes. They had bought, the bank never became involved, and what distinguishes this case from the Flanagan case, not for what Mr. K said, In Flanagan, there was a deed of trust taken on the very day. There was interim financing for the contractor, but there was a deed of trust signed with the bank's vice president as the beneficiary on the very day. That's very distinguishable from this case.
Why?
Because in that instance, the bank was not really acting just as interim financier for the construction of the home. They were envisioning that they were going to go on and continue on as a permanent financier. And when in the Flanagan situation, when the bank foreclosed, they foreclosed on that deed of trust. Also very distinguishable because in that case...
What is the difference, though, between the deed of trust and the M&M lien?
Well, the M&M lien is, in response to your earlier question, how can a bank, under Mr. K's arguments, not ultimately always be, he deems, a consumer and subject to whatever the contractor does wrong? If in an interim contractor lien, in an interim construction lien context, they're simply trying to provide financing.
Well, but that's not his argument. He's saying that they did things after they got into it, making demands when things weren't finished.
But the demands were legally allowable under this court's ruling in Ogden, and the house was finished. That's the point, and that's what the court below saw, the trial court.
But was it finished because Mr. Brown paid out $20,000 to get it completed?
Well, and the evidence, the record reflects Mr. Brown didn't pay $20,000.
Well, that's what the jury found.
But the point would be that if Mr. Brown had paid something and was entitled to some different number in terms of a determination of deficiency, that issue could have been resolved at a trial. Mr. K initially started a lawsuit with a wrongful foreclosure claim, amongst others. At trial, he submitted just the DTPA cause of action. Ogden says that trying to exercise your rights on partial foreclosure and then decide later how much is due on the deficiency does not constitute a DTPA cause of action. He can't go forward on a DTPA claim based upon Ogden for our exercise of our legal rights in the foreclosure context. That's the reason that the trial court granted the JNOB. There was no evidence to support the jury finding. Flanagan is also substantially different. Mr. K wants to talk about Flanagan's lead case. Flanagan's also substantially different because there's two things that make it extremely different. One, the house was 20% complete. The house wasn't left. Well, they foreclosed on the deed of trust when the house was 20% complete. They were there at the initial point of the transaction.
Does that go to whether there was a violation as opposed to whether there was a consumer, whether the plaintiff was a consumer?
And perhaps goes to both, Your Honor.
You see how it goes to the latter. Well, I'm seeing us to the former, because the whole argument here is whether there was some duty to complete it, what it was completed, who had it, who did what, but as to whether they're a consumer, how does that affect that?
Well, in order to be a consumer, they have to show that you're either involved in initial sales transaction or that you did something wrong yourself. I submit as the bank Galveston, we've done nothing wrong ourselves. And I urge the court to try to hold Mr. K. If you look through his briefing, there's not a single, he goes through five general things he says we did wrong. And other than his just unsupported argument that we have become Compion and that all those disputes of Compion between Mr. Compion and Mr. Brown are ours, he doesn't set forth anything to show that the bank did anything wrong.
Other 20 years of this jurisprudence under the DPPA, I'm not aware of a single case where a court has looked to see if there was a violation in order to determine whether you were a consumer or not. This is an initial question.
Well,
unrelated to anything beyond the relationship between the parties. Then there may be a violation or not, but I'm a consumer when I go buy lunch today. Maybe a perfectly good lunch that I'm happy with. But that doesn't mean I'm not a consumer, does it?
Consumer as to the provider of the service, the provider of the good of the service.
If you have a banking, you have a relationship with a bank, if it's Riverside, whatever that means, you're not a consumer, and if it's Plinican, you are a consumer. But it doesn't have anything to do with whether the transaction was satisfactory or not.
Well, his dissatisfaction with the transaction is really his gripe against Mr. Compion. If we're going to have banks as interim lenders, and for purposes of jurisprudence, if we're going to have banks as interim lenders and avoiding a situation where they're always going to ultimately be deemed a consumer, Mr. K. Relates, that's a stretch of the DPPA, far beyond what I believe the legislature ever intended. Flanagan you've got the bank there from the outset. Here we came in a year later before we ever took the collateral assignment. He had his contract with the underlying contractor in 84. The collateral assignment, the loan back was done a year later.
It's hard to see what difference it makes.
Well, in terms of the stretch, Your Honor, how close are you to the relationship? The DTPA cases all require you to be connected to the transaction. And I'm arguing, and the court below argued, and I submit for jurisprudence purposes, this court can affirm the court below simply on no evidence point. Our reply point one argues correctly, I believe, that...
Which is court of appeals never addressed.
But they did, Your Honor. I think the court of appeals was concerned by the fact that Flanagan is factually distinguishable from this. I think the court of appeals below was trying to say, let's call Flanagan what it really is. Flanagan's a situation where the bank was there. The bank was there from day one. And it looks at other things. It looks at the fact that in Flanagan, the jury found them to be, the foreclosure was unconscionable. Express finding that the foreclosure was unconscionable, perhaps responding to the Chief Justice's requirement of, in that instance in Flanagan, they looked at a specific thing and said, yes, it was something that was unconscionable, created the cause of action. The bank didn't contest it. It went up uncontested. So the issue before the court in Flanagan, this court, was an uncontested admission of a wrongful foreclosure, in effect. That's far from the case here, because given the language, that partial completion language I referred to the court, and Ogden, it's an entirely different situation. And I think for jurisprudence, it can be affirmed on no evidence point. I submit, though, that what this court wrote in Amstead v. Brass is we're trying to define Flanagan. Flanagan has been picked up by many, many courts of appeals. And I looked at the last year, and it's 30 cases. I think this court in Brass was saying there has to be some connection. And my response to you, Justice Heck, is that I think it's too far. I think the difference here is that the bank coming in and doing nothing more than exercising its legal rights under its loan documents, that house was complete. They didn't have any obligation to go in and complete it. There's nothing that the bank did wrong other than exercise its legal rights to a foreclosure under its documents. That can't constitute DTPA. If there's some issue of a wrongful foreclosure, Mr. Brown, Mr. Kay should have submitted that at trial, should have tried the wrongful foreclosure issue. They did not. They argued that they were a consumer, that they somehow had to reach this consumer status, not only to Mr. Compion, but he wants to say that we're in the stand in the shoes of Mr. Compion. We don't. We don't stand in the shoes of Mr. Compion.
Well,
go ahead. It may be that there's no liability here, as you argue that. But putting that aside, it's kind of hard to see why you're a consumer if the whole thing closes pretty quick. One of the interim financing and original agreement with the builder all happens at pretty close at the same time, but not if it stretches out. Looks to me like the reasoning of Flanagan is whenever that occurs, the prospective owner is thinking, I'm getting the house, even if maybe he thought that earlier too, but at least he's thinking it now.
Mr. Brown got his house, and he didn't have to pay for it either, Your Honor. He got his house, and if ultimately someone takes some collateral assignment at some point down the line, no matter how far out it is, and Mr. Brown has no relationship with that person, other than that person took on the paper from someone else, the logical extension of Mr. K's argument is yes. That person's a DTPA. I've got a consumer relationship because it relates to my house. And therefore, anything in paper that goes with my house, the underlying security documents, all create something that the person with whom Mr. Brown has instance testified, talked to him, had no involvement with him, didn't do anything with him. 5 months into construction, he gets a CC on a piece of paper from them saying, yeah, you know, Mr. Compion, come on, we're trying to monitor what you're doing in terms of progress on this house. We're going to make advances. They're doing that as the bank. They're not doing it for Mr. Brown. And that's just prudent conduct of an interim lender. He wants to take from that and bootstrap from that. That somehow creates a DTPA consumer status between him and the bank. His only gripe really is the foreclosure. And the foreclosure under Ogden is an action on the DTPA. He put himself out by doing that.
Would that be true? Is that true also if the bank foreclosed on the wife's interest?
Your Honor, that's a bit, Aaron. I urge the court that I don't. I can't respond to that. They're all the statement of facts, but I have them in my brief. The wife clearly was not disclosed to anyone prior to the bank's foreclosure. In fact, when the bank was foreclosing, the bank was in contact with Mr. K. Mr. K had already arrived on the scene, and Mr. K was writing letters to the bank on behalf of Mr. Brown. There was never any disclosure whatsoever of Mrs. Brown. To the contrary of what Mr. K has said today, the record reflects that he was submitting documents, and at trial, rather cute, he said, "I was a single man. I didn't understand what that meant." He filled out, he signed checks, all his documents are all Mr. Brown. There's no reference. He's called himself a single man. The bank can't be held to.
On what document did he swear state that he was a single man?
I believe it's renewal and extension of the Amico vendors lien, Your Honor, as well as, and this is off the top of my head, and I'm happy to write something on letters of the court to point this out. There's also I believe the timing of his financing with the permanent lender was a few months after he actually signed a note to Mr. Compion. So that places it into 1985. His wife, Mr. Brown, was married in 1984. So I believe his representations to that permanent financier, which are all part of the record later, the bank didn't have the benefit of until after they'd already foreclosed, when he's trying to set aside the liens for the first time, telling us about his wife. And we addressed that in the briefing as to why that created an estoppel for Mr. Brown. But most importantly, the jurisprudence issue there is he didn't submit any issue whatsoever as to the validity of the lien at trial. Didn't raise the issue. So the issue I submit is waived as to the validity of the lien. And the record reflects Mr. K. He's got an attorney's fee testimony. There's an entry there where they decided to let the foreclosure go forward. They knew about it. He was represented by counsel. There's no disclosure of the wife. I think they've waived that issue entirely. Yet they want to argue that now as a fallback as to why the liens are invalid. Your Honor.
A question on the Ogden case. You assert that because they foreclosed under the documents, Ogden says you don't have a DTPA action.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that based on the theory that a mere breach of contract is not a DTPA claim?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in essence it is.
Query then, if they foreclose, but they don't do it in accordance with the contract, it's still a breach. Is that right?
Perhaps it's a breach of contract, Your Honor. Perhaps there should have been some argument for some kind of a contractual set-off. It's not the DTPA cause of action.
In other words, even the argument that they made a demand for more than they were entitled to because they hadn't advanced the full amount of the note on the interim financing, that's nothing more than a breach of contract. Secondly, if they didn't give him credit for the amounts that he spent or said he spent to complete, that's nothing more than a breach of contract.
It would be a breach of contract, Your Honor. And this court wrote, and that exact argument before the court, and out of Ogden, says, therefore, any demand for the amount of the note cannot be a deceptive trade practice.
So would you then say, even if Mr. Brown was a consumer as to the bank, he still can't recover because Ogden says there's no claim there?
Yes, Your Honor, even if he were a consumer. And I say there's no evidence that he's
Well, I understand that. I mean, assuming that he is.
If he were a consumer, he's not set forth any wrongdoing by the bank because what the bank is doing is exercise its legal right, protected by Ogden. If there's something that they have claimed for, it would be a breach of contract or some form of a contractual set-off claim on the division.
All right, so then under your theory and under your argument, because the only claim was DTPA, and there's no breach under Ogden, no claim under Ogden, then you're entitled to a render in your favor.
Yes, Your Honor, I submit, though, even above that argument, I think that's not a consumer argument, but even above that argument, no evidence of wrongdoing by the bank, because I think the evidence was that the house was completed April 9th of 87.
Well, but your Ogden argument is a legal argument, not a factual one.
Yes.
Didn't
the jury find against him on the completion issue? No, Your Honor. There was not a completion finding per se. What they did was he just submitted general arguments of was there a misrepresentation, was there some unconscionable act, without any specification of what it was. The testimony, the damages are a bit muddled in there in the damage calculation, and it talks about what would be additional damages and so forth. There was mixed testimony on that.
What was the damage issue?
He had several damage findings as to Mr. Brown's testimony as to to additional work that he had done or work he wanted to do on the house, which I would submit would just go to that contractual claim if he had one as to what the deficiency would be after foreclosure if we're exercising the percent of the option.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Responding to Justice Owens' question, the jury did find non-completion. The jury found non-completion by finding all of the actual damages which it found for the non-completion. No question was asked specifically of the jury, was there a non-completion or was the house complete? The jury was simply asked about damages for the non-completion. Counsel has argued to this court.
Are you saying that the submission to the jury was a general question that combined both breach of contract and the amounts? In other words, what amount of damages were incurred by Brown for non-completion and then gave ABCD?
Something like that, yes, sir. I'm not sure I believe it was a question, but counsel was yes, we did submit a DTPA theory and a DTPA theory only. Counsel is correct. We did not ask questions about did the work start early because that was admitted, and we only asked questions about what's not admitted. No question was asked, was Vincent married? Because he was married. The evidence was undisputed that he was married. The bank could have asked for, at the time that it submitted all its other documents, a marital status affidavit. We all know the title companies do that an awful lot. We've all got it in our word processor, fill in the blanks. Had Vincent been asked that, he would have denied it. He would have declined to claim that because he would have said, but guys, I am married. The house, according to counsel, was completed in April of 1987, but in September of 1987, 5 months later, the bank is writing to Vincent saying, we know the house is not completed. Either complete it yourself at your own cost and pay us the entire amount due, or we'll foreclose, we'll take possession, and we'll complete the house. You can't have it that way. The initial contact with Compion, as counsel pointed out, was in 1984, and the papers were signed in 1985. No question about that. But that's the initial contact. Hello, I'm trying to build a house. Are you a contractor? What about these plans? What about these specifications? Well, let's change this and let's move this. And finally, in 1985, that's when the contract between Compion and Brown is signed. And on the same day, that's when Compion borrows the money from the bank and collaterally assigns his interest, his note, his M&M Lane contract. There's none of this long delay.
Okay. Can you respond to the bank's argument here that under Ogden, there can be no liability as a matter of law?
Ogden is readily distinguishable. No question about it. You can foreclose for partial completion. I agree with that. I've always agreed with that. But you've got to make the subtraction. You can't say we're going to foreclose for the full amount when the house is not complete. What you can say is we're going to foreclose on the incomplete house and make a subtraction. You owed us $75,000. The house still needs $50,000 or $20,000 or something. We're going to foreclose on this difference.
But how do you say that? You post it for foreclosure, you bid a price, and then there's a dispute about whether you owe part of that or not. Isn't that what it comes down to?
No, in this case, the dispute arose as the bank knew long before the bank foreclosed, long before its foreclosure on Brown. In fact, it had arisen before its foreclosure on Compion. The bank knew of the incompletion. This letter that I keep referring to is dated September of 87. They didn't foreclose until September of 87. December of 87. They knew at the time of the foreclosure of the incompleteness and yet demanded the full amount.
What they did is demand a lesser amount than something more than Brown thought was owed. There was simply a dispute about what the appropriate set-off was. Is that an ECPA violation? The bank didn't get it right on the note?
I think it depends on the wording of their demand letter. that they certainly can ask for an amount to be determined. Let's talk about it. In this case, the evidence was, admitted over my objection because of the settlement negotiations I contended, that Brown had said, don't foreclose them. This is before the foreclosure. In the presence of me and the bank's lawyer, Mr. Ryder, and the bank's representative, I think Mr. Lee, the president of the bank, don't foreclose. Let's see if we can agree on the amount that it's going to take to fix. Make a subtraction or you fix. And the bank said, no, you don't understand. This is all in the testimony. We want the full amount.
No, but it's the bank. You
can ask. I apologize.
It's a question. The bank says, we're going to foreclose. We don't want to make it. And they have, in their mind, an amount what is all the deductions, the property is worth. They post it, they foreclose it. Then there's a dispute about what they set off on. Is that a DTPA going forward and foreclose? That DTPA violation?
Let me try and answer it this way. I've started out my life representing banks. Our rule was, in that firm, when there's going to be a question, judicially foreclose, go to the court and ask them to help you, because then there can be no dispute. I think the bank runs a risk on a non-judicial foreclosure when it unilaterally sets an amount. I know that you owe me $75,000 under the note, but I'm only demanding $50,000 because I think that it's only going to take $25,000 to fix and to pay off the M&M liens. We've not even talked about those today. But I'm only going to demand $50,000. And if you don't pay the $50,000, I'm going to non-judicially foreclose. I think the bank is running a risk.
What if they're wrong at $47,000 as opposed to $50,000? Is that a DTPA violation?
There is a case which holds that it is. It's not a foreclosure case. It's a demand for too much interest. The higher amount was paid. Very bad case name. The higher amount was paid, then a DTPA claim was made. The argument was you shouldn't have paid it. That's not a DTPA violation. The court said, yes, it is. I believe it to be a court of appeals decision, however.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That completes the argument in the third cause. The court has had a slight change of schedule, and the counsel in the fourth case are aware of it. We will take a recess until 1:30 p.m., and we will come and resume then and hear the final argument.
All rise.